Welcome to episode 6 of How Positive Are You, a weekly program offering news and views from the other side of AIDS. I'm Christine Maggiore, author of the book, What If Everything You Thought You Knew About AIDS Was Wrong?
And I'm David Crow, president of Rethinking AIDS, an international organization of doctors, scientists, journalists, educators, and legal experts who question the role of HIV in AIDS causation.
In today's show, we'll learn how HIV tests work, or perhaps more correctly, don't work, as we talk with Dr. Rodney Richards, an organic chemist and developer of diagnostic tests. Dr. Richards is a founding scientist at Amgen Incorporated, one of the largest and most successful biotech firms in the world, and was an active part of the company when it was hired by Abbott Laboratories to create the very first HIV antibody test in 1984. Since leaving Amgen, Dr. Richards has authored several papers on the inability of any type of HIV test to diagnose actual HIV infection. One paper he authored on the unscientific way being HIV antibody positive became equated with being HIV infected, a position adopted by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control without scientific validation, was recently reprinted in the book Serious Adverse Events, An Uncensored History of AIDS by journalist Celia Farber. But before we welcome Dr. Richards to the program, David has some feedback from our listeners.
Yeah, we've had a great response. First of all, we've had over 2,500 downloads of our 5 episodes so far. Laura from New York wrote, "I love the podcast you're doing with Christine." Terry from Washington, D.C. says, "Just wanted to let you both know that your weekly podcasts are great." Fintan Dunn from AIDSisOver.com in Ireland said, "David, way to go with your new audios with Christine. I'm enjoying them." Adam said, "Great show. I listened to the entire things. Congratulations and keep up the great work." Jock, who's a birthing expert, said, "Nice job." Raina from Las Vegas told us how the stories of men experiencing inconsistent test results affected her. "It's interesting always to hear what others have to say about their lives, and these men's stories were sad because they felt the need to stay in the closet." Jason from Florida said, "I loved the podcast What is AIDS on July 18th with Steve's story. That was a great one." Jason is also HIV positive. He says, "By the way, I have not been sick in 2 years since my, quote, diagnosis, unquote. Not even a sniff, cough, or anything. Interesting, isn't it?" Karsten says, "I just wanted to let you and Christine know that I have spent the last 4 days during my travels to and from jobs listening to the podcast. I walked around the huge park in the rain today listening to the last one. It was great. Many emotions it has taken me through. I absolutely love it and appreciate so much that you guys are doing this. Please keep making them every week." Well, we haven't been so great on the every week thing, but we've decided we're going to fix that.
Yeah, and I take responsibility for that, David. I've been busy with my lawsuit. And just to let you and everybody else in the world know, we now have a court date for our trial. This is our civil suit against the County of Los Angeles, and it's February 9th. So everyone out there, light candles, say prayers, and all that good stuff for justice to prevail when we head into court here in Los Angeles on February 9th.
I certainly hope justice will prevail, and hopefully we'll be able to cover this more on the podcast.
That would be great. So, David, you have some news items to share.
Yeah, I've got 3 of them this week. A lot has been made about a recent estimate published in the journal Nature that HIV is 100 years old. Well, that's what they're reporting in the newspapers. Well, if you look a little further, it's not really exactly 100 years. It's somewhere between 1884 and 1924. What the newspapers aren't really telling you is that this is based on 2 samples from Kinshasa, the Democratic Republic of Congo is where that's now located, in respectively 1959 and 1960 that tested positive for what's claimed to be the HIV genome. If you read the paper, however, you see that these 2 samples were dramatically different despite being sampled 1 year apart in the same location. That doesn't stop scientists. They just use the 2 data points to claim that obviously HIV had diversified by that time, indicating it must have evolved for a long time, hence the 100-year estimate. But what if what they're measuring is not a virus? After all, they don't have particles. What if it's just DNA or RNA produced by some disease process, perhaps influenced by a person's genetic makeup, the diseases, chemicals, vaccines, and stresses they've been exposed to? If that's the case, this whole research project means nothing. Or what if they'd found two people who had similar DNA, which was possible, because obviously if it was a sexually transmitted disease, there would be multiple people carrying it. If that had been the case, the scientists would have said HIV arose in Kinshasa in 1958. It's just remarkable how this science, based on two data points, has achieved such widespread attention.
I'm wondering, too, if it's 100 years old, how come there wasn't a problem 100 years ago or 90 years ago?
Well, that's an excellent observation. I mean, if HIV had been around in Africa, let's say from 1924, that's the outer limit of their estimate, and there was
Let's throw in a latency period of 10. Let's make it a 20-year. Let's make it a 30-year latency period.
Well,
just
that
to
would
be
still
really generous.
Be 1954. They would have been seeing cases of AIDS in Africa, but they claim that they arose in the 1980s along with AIDS in America. So it is remarkable that a virus would stay quiescent until something happened in America.
30, 50 years, 100 years later.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that don't add up about that that research. But speaking of old things, what about the Roman Empire? Some French researchers have claimed that the Roman Empire is the reason why AIDS spread throughout Europe. And I'm not making this up. This is not a joke. They're actually saying this. They're saying that countries that were in the empire longest, such as Spain, France, and Italy, have the lowest frequency of a gene known as CCR5. Those on the fringes of the empire, such as the UK and Germany, have a higher frequency, and countries that were never in the Roman Empire have the highest. And the CCR gene is often claimed to help protect against HIV infection or progression. But when I've looked at the actual research, I find a lot of papers that have surprised scientists saying, we didn't find any connection between CCR5 and HIV infection. One example here from Italy, since that was the center of the Roman Empire, they found a 78-year-old man who tested HIV positive, but had never had any signs or symptoms of HIV infection since 1985. This was reported in 2000, so at least 15 years. And he had no evidence of the CCR5 mutations that were believed to confer immunity. That's only one person. There's another study from 2001 that looked at hemophiliacs, found that only 7 out of 43 who were remaining healthy despite... who were remaining HIV negative despite a very high risk, only 7 out of 43 had the protective gene. Another paper in 2002 showed that of 17 women who remained uninfected despite a history of heavy exposure through repeated unprotected sexual contact, none of the women had the protective gene.
Well, isn't what you're saying, or what they're saying, too, that if you're outside the area of the Roman Empire, that you would be more likely to have this allegedly protective gene. And Africa being well outside the Roman Empire, I mean, Mussolini was messing around there much later, but wouldn't Africa then be likely to have the population there to have this supposedly protective gene, yet those are the people said to be most at risk, most affected?
Well, that's true. I mean, they always talk about sub-Saharan Africa, which would have probably hardly have even known that the Roman Empire existed. The Romans did conquer some small parts of North Africa, but those are not considered to be at risk for AIDS.
Yeah, North Africa, interestingly, is just completely off the AIDS map.
Right, and of course, that's the place where the Romans, through their merchant navy and their fleets of ships, would have had a lot of influence, and there would have been a lot of interactions.
Plus, here's some evidence for you. I'm Italian, and I've been positive for almost 17 years without any problem. So what's up with my CC? What's it? CCR5?
Well, maybe you should get tested for CCR5, and we could test the hypothesis ourselves.
Just what I need, another test.
Yeah, that's right. That's, I think, called buying into the paradigm. If you don't believe in the tests, I think it's dangerous to take them. But that's a whole other topic.
It is indeed.
My last news item, of course, this is really the big one, is that the Nobel Prize for medicine and physiology was awarded to Luc Montagnier and Françoise Barré-Sinoussi from the Pasteur Institute, along with the man who claimed to have discovered the HPV virus, which is now being blamed for cervical cancer. What's notable in this award is the absence of Robert Gallo. He's barely mentioned in some of the more detailed documentation. This seems to be a conclusion. They seem to have accepted the conclusion that Robert Gallo used samples from the Pasteur Institute for their experiments. And some of these people from the Nobel Committee have actually said this is going to stop people questioning HIV and AIDS, because now I suppose they think they found the person who really discovered HIV. It's not Robert Gallo, it's Luc Montagnier and Françoise Barré-Sinoussi.
And what's interesting about that is if you read the 1997 interview published in Continuum magazine with Montagnier, he says clearly we didn't purify, we didn't isolate, we didn't find a unique retrovirus. They found things associated with the retrovirus that led them to believe that a retrovirus could be there, but they didn't find HIV or HTLV or any variant on that name.
Yes, that's a really good point. The Nobel Committee itself published only two diagrams or figures from the research. One of them was a picture of particles budding from CD4 cells. That pretty much shows they didn't purify the virus, because if they had, they would have shown that picture. It also emphasizes the fact that they were using these weird cell culture techniques, which can cause all kinds of strange phenomena. So budding of particles is not really too significant. And you can't tell from looking at particles whether they're viral or they're microvesicles or something else. They also showed a graph of reverse transcriptase activity, except that it's not reverse transcriptase activity. It's radioactive measurements, which are a couple of assumptions removed from actually showing that that enzyme is present. And in any case, that enzyme is not unique to retroviruses. So it's good in a way that the Nobel Committee has shown the evidence that's quite easy to refute.
It's interesting, too, because in recent interviews that Montagnier has done, he sounds like an AIDS dissident. He says that he is a proponent of the cofactor idea of AIDS and that he believes that oxidative stress is the real culprit when it comes to a damaged immune system. He has also said in this filmed interview that I saw that a person who tests positive and who is healthy and well-nourished and not in oxidative stress, that their immune system will render HIV harmless. And that if you take someone whose immune system is compromised, and that might be an oxidative stress, if you remedy that situation through proper nourishment, that they too will render HIV harmless through a healthy immune system. And then to put the icing on the cake here with his recent comments, he says that the drugs are toxic. The antiretroviral drugs, as they're called, are toxic. They cannot be endured over the course of a lifetime.
So yes, and even he, in some of his recent writings, he sounds like an alternative health practitioner. Like, here's a French book, for example. This is from the French Amazon website, and this is my rough translation. Live a long and healthy life, an extraordinary ally, fermented papaya.
And that's from Montagnier's recent book published in French.
21st of August 2008, so just a couple of months ago, he's saying, you know, use nutritional extracts to live a healthy and long life. And his new book, which is still only in French on AIDS, talks a lot about oxidative stress, which is what the Perth Group has been talking about for, I guess, about 20 years.
It's interesting, because if the Nobel Prize Committee thought they might end the debate by awarding a prize 24 years after the non-discovery of HIV to the other alleged discoverers, I think they opened up a bigger one, because here you have the so-called discoverer saying things exactly like what people who are outside of the mainstream, so to speak, are saying. It's oxidative stress. It's harmless. If you're well-nourished and healthy, you can be fine. The drugs are nonspecific and toxic and can't be endured over a lifetime.
Yeah, it's really quite amazing. And I think it gives new avenues to combat some of the propaganda. And I mean, one good thing is that it really puts Gallo's research on the back burner. And despite what the Nobel Committee says, most science that I've read, if they cite any references at all that they consider proof that HIV causes AIDS, they're quoting the Gallo work.
That's what was published in Science, and that became the foundation of the whole notion that HIV causes AIDS was Gallo's papers in Science, which we might infer now from the Nobel Award are not correct.
Yes, in fact, I'm working on a letter which I hope to get signed by a number of top scientists to actually withdraw those letters from the scientific record. It will be an interesting exercise. It's hard to see science losing so much face, but there are so many questions about those papers. They should be out of the scientific record. Science students should not look at them as seminal research. They should look at them as wrong, probably fraudulent research. That's what they are.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all I have for news for this week.
I think that's quite a lot. And how about if we get Dr. Richards on the line?
Yeah, let's give him a call.
Okay. So welcome to How Positive Are You, Dr. Richards. It's great to have you with us today, and we look forward, along with our listeners, to learning something about HIV tests.
Well, thank you for inviting me to speak with you today.
Thanks for being on the show, Rodney. And let me start by asking you to describe your work at Amgen, when you started there, and what kinds of things you worked on.
Yes, I actually began working with Amgen approximately 12 months after groundbreaking. At that time, it was called Applied Molecular Genetics, and I was hired as a synthetic organic chemist to perfect a novel chemical reaction that was developed by Dr. Marvin Carruthers' labs at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And that reaction was for the purpose of creating DNA from scratch, in other words, small molecules, and we could create entire genes. Well, at least that was the goal. And we actually achieved that goal. When I began working at Amgen, our facility at that time was quite a shock to me. I'd actually driven up to what I thought was the right address, and there was a building that said Genes on the outside of it, and I presumed that was the place. And I walked in. It turned out to be Genes Auto Garage. And they pointed me to another building. And I walked in that building, and it was actually just a garage with no running water other than the bathroom. We had a space heater in the ceiling for our heat, and the garage door served as our fume hood when we needed to get rid of stinky organic solvents.
Well, Amgen has certainly come a long way. What kind of business are they doing today, if you know in dollars, Rodney?
Oh, Amgen is about 14,000 employees today, and their annual earnings are right around $14 billion as well.
So that was an interesting beginning to what became, you could say, one of the greatest success stories in biotech.
Yeah, I certainly had no idea when I walked into that garage that the company would be that successful, clearly.
And just to go back to your own beginning, what was it that motivated you to get into that line of study and work? What was it that you hoped to accomplish with your studies and eventual work?
Well, organic chemistry was just something I was attracted to because I enjoyed the creative process, the ability to create something brand new from scratch. When I heard that Dr. Carruthers had developed this technology to create DNA, I was just overwhelmed with the possibilities. what that meant was, among other things, we could take any published DNA sequence and create it in the laboratory, saving massive amounts of time trying to isolate it from humans.
Rodney, before you started at Amgen, you did a PhD. Can you describe your research for the PhD and whether it was published anywhere?
Yeah, my research during my PhD was as a what we call synthetic organic chemist. And in this sense, organic does not mean healthy. It means creating molecules that are mostly composed of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen. And the vast majority of drugs on the market are created by chemists in organic chemistry labs. And specifically, my project was to create an organic molecule that would shuttle products across cell membranes. In other words, if you could get a drug from the outside to the inside of the cell, it may increase its potency. As an interesting side effect to that research, I had created the world's first molecular Möbius strip. And for those that don't know what a Möbius strip is, it's if you take a piece of paper, a strip of paper, and put a half twist in it and stick the ends together, it's a structure that only has one surface, and if you cut it in half, it doesn't fall into two parts. It actually creates one large circle.
It's a great party trick.
I'm sorry? Oh, you use that as a party
trick. Yeah, it's a great party trick. Yes, especially with little kids. They think it's pretty neat.
Oh, I loved it, and I actually did cut my organic molecule in half using chemicals, and that was one of the ways we proved that it was indeed a Möbius strip, because it did create one larger circle. That was a fortunate side effect to my research, because that was published in science news magazines around the world.
Now, in April of 1984, Dr. Robert Gallo announced to the world that he had discovered the probable cause of AIDS, a retrovirus that would later be named HIV. And this somehow found its way to you, Rodney. Could you explain your involvement from the very beginning of HIV diagnostics?
Sure. As I mentioned earlier, we were successful in creating DNA from scratch, and that led me into a different field called DNA diagnostics. It was just developing. And the ability to synthesize DNA that's complementary to the DNA of a germ, for example, allowed us to create very, very sensitive diagnostic products. And Abbott Laboratories, which is one of the world's largest diagnostic labs, had expressed an interest in Amgen's technologies, and we had formed a collaborative arrangement where Amgen would tailor their new high-tech into, hopefully, faster, more accurate diagnostic tests that Abbott could push to the market. And that began in 1984, just shortly after they had licensed the patent rights to Bob Gallo's novel reagents. So I was fortunate to be able to start that collaboration at a time when that first so-called HIV diagnostic test was being developed at Abbott Laboratories.
Now, you've come around to the point of view through your experience in and around the diagnostic testing world that HIV tests don't test for HIV itself, and they can't tell us if someone is actually infected with HIV through the detection of antibodies or genetic material. In this podcast, what we'd like to do is have you explain to us how the antibody tests work and don't work, and then we'll move on to the other kinds of diagnostics that are used around the whole HIV hypothesis. Could you start with just a brief explanation of how antibody tests are supposed to work?
Yeah, of course. Maybe I'll just talk about what an antibody is. Antibodies are proteins that are synthesized by our body in response to infection with a germ. And basically, they're proteins that bind to the germ, and in so doing, they either interfere with the ability of that germ to bind to other cells, and thereby stopping the infection. Or they mark that cells that are infected for digestion by other cells in the body. These antibodies are they're a very precise fit to the germ, and that's why you can use them to create diagnostic products. An antibody test, be it for syphilis, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, HIV, whatever, you're looking for antibodies to a germ, a particular germ. And in general, I call this, if you do get a positive antibody test to a particular germ, that's indirect evidence, I should say, of current or past infection. But they cannot be used to diagnose infection, not with any disease.
Now, what is the distinction here? Because some people will confuse this, I've noticed, and say, oh, there's the FDA's never said that there is a test for testing for HIV, which is incorrect. The FDA has approved things called HIV tests. What do they do, and what are they approved for if it's not for the actual diagnosing of HIV infection?
Well, that's a very good question. And you're right. The FDA has approved, I think, some 36 diagnostic test kits for medical use that contain the term HIV in the title. But if you look closely, you'll see that it's either HIV antibodies or HIV, HIV antigens, or HIV viral load, but none of them declare that they can be used to diagnose infection with HIV. So when you hear HIV test, in reality, none of those products even claim to be able to diagnose HIV infection with any degree of stated accuracy.
But if you're finding HIV antibodies, doesn't that indicate you had at least an infection and perhaps have one now?
Well, what it indicates is that you have antibodies in your body that are binding to the test kit. There's a possibility of false positives, and this became apparent with trying to test syphilis with antibodies. They're called biological false positives. And it means that on follow-up testing with another technology called culture, many people who were thought to be positive for syphilis based on antibody tests were, of course, found to be actually negative. And so there's a possibility that you do not have the germ. Even if you throw out the possibility of false positives, no, these tests cannot tell you if the germ is present. It's kind of like, I use an example. If you see a paw print in the forest of a fox, that doesn't mean that the fox is still there. It would mean, indeed, that the fox was there.
Now, with HIV, there's been some question about the fox. Is there a fox? And you mentioned these reactions to what's in the test kits. What is in the test kits? Do we know that that is HIV-specific? Is there evidence of a fox?
Well, of course, it depends on who you talk to. But when Abbott Laboratories put out their first HIV antibody test, they were very clear to put in their package insert, and this is the literature that comes with the test that's required by the FDA, that there really is no recognized standard for determining the presence or absence of HIV antibodies in a sample. And that's still true today. So what they used for their what's known as a gold standard, which is what you hold up against your test results to see how well it performed. And they had no gold standard because there was no test, even elaborate test for HIV at that time. And excuse me again. So what they used as their gold standard is people with clinical AIDS were presumed to be HIV positive, and healthy blood donors were presumed to be negative for HIV infection in the past or whatever, or currently. And so that's how they assess the accuracy of their test kit.
So just to get this straight, on the thing called the HIV antibody test, there's a disclaiming sentence that says there's no recognized standard for determining the presence or absence of HIV antibody in human blood?
That's correct.
And we decided that certain samples were positive and contained HIV because blood was taken from original AIDS patients who tested positive, and from their positive tests, it was assumed they had a virus, and negative people were assumed not to have a virus? Is that roughly?
That's very close. When this test was first coming out, even the Center for Disease Control emphasized, and I'll read you a quote here, a positive test for most individuals in populations at greater risk of acquiring AIDS will probably mean the individual has been infected at some time. Whether the person is currently affected or immune is not known based on serological tests, meaning based on the antibody test. So at that time, all mainstream researchers realized you could not use antibodies for diagnosing an infection.
But that changed in the era of AIDS at some point. Like, why did that change? Why did people suddenly assume that an antibody was proof of current infection?
Well, that was actually just announced. It was never proven. It was never demonstrated. It was never shown. It's interesting, the CDC in 1987 just sort of unilaterally announced that the presence of antibody is equivalent to infection without citing any scientific study to establish this. And it's even more baffling because if you take antibody-positive persons and draw their blood and perform what's known as a culture, and I don't know if we'll elaborate on that later, but it means you actually grow the germ, many, many antibody-positive people come up culture negative. So the culture says that they're not infected, and yet the antibody test, if you use this logic of the CDC, says that they are infected. So it's kind of a paradox.
And Rodney, is that not also true of antigen tests, that many people who are antibody positive are antigen negative, and yet an antigen test is supposedly looking directly for viral proteins, whereas an antibody test is just looking for your body's reaction to those proteins?
Yes, that is correct. That the majority of people that are considered positive for HIV based on antibody tests, test negative on what's called the P24 antigen test. And again, maybe I should explain a little bit about what the antigen test is. The antigen tests are, you'll see products in for antigen to numerous other germs as well. But in the case of an antigen test, what you're looking for is a protein building block of the germ. So if you properly characterized your germ, properly isolated your germ, you can break it into its protein fragments, and you stick those proteins onto a solid surface, generally a piece of plastic, believe it or not. And then you take the blood of the patient, the suspected patient, and you put it on that piece of plastic. And if antibodies are present, it'll stick to the plastic as well. So that's the principle of looking for antigen.
Now, you said something about a scientific study not existing that would establish or prove that you can use an antibody test in the case of HIV testing to say that someone's infected. What would a scientific study that, let's say, validates HIV test look like? And in your opinion, does that exist anywhere? Has that ever been done?
No, I've done a thorough search of the literature, and there, you know, I can't say that that study does not exist. But my position on this has appeared on several web pages, and I presume that the mainstream would be eager to send me that study and shut me up if it existed. And the proper study would be to compare your antibody test to the actual presence or absence of HIV, and that cannot be done. Nobody has ever isolated in pure form HIV to prove that these tests are meaningful. And I know it sounds outrageous, and it took me 5 years to convince myself that that was the case. In fact, when I was at Amgen, I actually had numerous patents that were issued in my name covering HIV diagnostic testing. So when I started to notice that that these so-called accuracies were mostly, they were centered around comparing one test to another test. So when people say that the HIV test is 99.99% accurate or whatever it's up to today, it's really important to say at what, because it's not at diagnosing HIV. And generally that those high numbers means it's 99.99% accurate. It's giving you the same answer as some other FDA-approved test.
And if that was the wrong answer, then it's really good at repeating the wrong answer.
That's correct. You've reproduced the wrong answer very accurately.
So to break down what a validation study would look like, I've always understood it to be something like this. You get 1,000 people who test HIV antibody positive, and you see from how many you can directly purify HIV, whole infectious HIV. If it's 1,000 out of 1,000, then the test truly would be 100% accurate. If it's 999 that have the virus who also test positive on the antibody test, then it's 99.9% accurate. Is that more or less how it would be?
Yeah, that's how you do it. And with germs like, I don't know, STDs, chlamydia, herpes, whatever, what you do is you first run your antibody or antigen test and see it on 1,000 samples and see what your results are. And then you do what's known as culture. And that means you grow the germ up, and you grow it up in sufficient quantities and purity that you can actually directly look at it with a microscope in the case of a bacterium, with electron microscope in the case of a virus, and you see it there. And so it's a direct validation of your test. And that's how you determine how many false positives, how many true positives, et cetera, et cetera. That technology does not exist with HIV.
Can you think of any reason why?
Well, I can tell you some mainstream reasons why HIV has never been directly isolated. You know, according to me, I'm a chemist. Let me back up. And as a chemist, before we can claim the isolation of a new molecule or the creation of a new molecule, it's an absolute requirement that you get that molecule in a purity of excess of 99.5%. And the reason for that requirement is so that your observations with spectrographic information, infrared, spectra, et cetera, is indeed coming from a single entity rather than a combination of entities. The virologists today don't really consider that a necessary step to prove the existence of a new germ. In other words, they find phenomenon in these cultures, but they've never been able to actually purify this hypothetical HIV in sufficient quantities so that it can be directly characterized.
In recent news about the Nobel Prize being awarded to Luc Montagnier and his cohort, Dr. Francois Barr, I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name, Sanusi?
I'm not sure either.
Yeah, well, okay, what's her face?
I think it's Barré Sanusi.
Barré Sanusi, okay. Pardon me, Francois. I wanted to ask you, I noticed that in a 1997 interview around the question, did Montagnier isolate or purify HIV, he seems to say that he didn't, that what he based the assumption that HIV was there on was the detection of indirect evidence, such as reverse transcriptase activity, or what he called, I'll give it the French pronunciation, the assemblage of factors that allowed him to imagine that if these other things associated with the retrovirus were there, then a retrovirus must be there.
Right. It's HIV exists as a matter of faith. All the evidence is indirect. again, as a chemist, it's indirect to me because until you've purified something, how can you say that it exists? But the indirect evidence is good, but it's not good enough for an organic chemist. And indeed, Luc Montagnier admitted that he never did purify the virus. Well, they jumped through the hoops of purifying the virus because this is what goes into the test kits. But if you actually purify, or I should say jump through the hoops of purifying HIV, and you take that material out and put it under an electron microscope, you don't see pure HIV. You see some small particles that are referred to as virus-like. And Luc Montagnier says the reason for that is because it's a very fragile virus. So after you purify it, you can't see it because it falls apart, is the notion. But then people have double purified HIV. So if you take the purified HIV and put it through the purification process again, which is a sucrose gradient, meaning these viral particles go through a sugar solution until they reach a certain density, you still see the HIV phenomena at the same place. So I guess it's kind of a paradox, is that if it fell apart on the first step, then you should not be able to purify it again, and you shouldn't see anything on the second step.
And so you're talking about things like reverse transcription, the conversion of RNA into DNA. That's what you mean by DNA.
Yeah, that's an enzyme activity that you look for, and if you see that enzyme activity, you presuppose that it's coming from HIV, even though you can't see the HIV there.
And even though if you're doubly purifying it, if it fell apart on the first purification, it can't be there for the second time, but the phenomena.
Right. It's still what is called banding. In other words, the viral particles have a very specific density. I think it's something like 1.16 grams per milliliter, where they travel through the solution when you centrifuge it, and they get to that density where they're happy. It's the same density as they are. And so it's really baffling as to why they travel to that same place the second time if they had died or committed suicide on the first round.
And when you're saying they, you're still referring to things that are associated or I guess you could say biochemical activities that are associated with
right.
the virus, but the they still isn't the virus.
In my opinion, no, because how can a virus obliterate itself after you purify it? That's the explanation for why we don't see it, you know, with an electron microscope. And yet, if you repeat the process, you once again see reverse transcriptase activity at the banding at that same place.
So if there's reverse transcriptase activity, the virus should be there making it happen.
That's the hypothesis.
But the virus isn't there, just the reverse transcriptase.
Right.
Okay,
so,
I just wanted to...
the phenomena's there, but the virus is not.
Turn to a slightly different subject. One of the things that I think is very important is the different levels of testing standards. Like my understanding in Canada and the U.S. is that in order to be diagnosed HIV positive, you have to have 3 ELISA tests, of which 2 have to be positive, followed by at least 1 reactive Western blot. Yet in places like Africa, often the best you're going to get is 1 ELISA test, possibly a rapid test followed by an ELISA test. Is that a reasonable summary of the state of HIV testing sequences?
Yes, it's an accurate state of the situation, and it's really tragic, I think, that there is no standardization of what constitutes a positive test result from country to country or laboratory to laboratory even. And excuse me. And some of this, of course, is for financial reasons. Like in Africa, it's very expensive to perform a so-called confirmatory Western blot test. So researchers figured out a way to get rid of it. And since there is no gold standard, in other words, since we cannot isolate HIV and prove its existence directly, there's no way to validate these various different algorithms to see which one is working and which one is not.
In the 1980s, a researcher by the name of Burke did some analyses where he looked at the first positive ELISA and then counted the number of cases where that was repeatedly positive. In other words, the second one was positive as opposed to negative, and he found that on the second ELISA, only about half of the first positive ELISAs were repeatable with a second ELISA. So if you had, say, a situation where you were doing three ELISAs, I think that would mean that only one-eighth of the people who tested positive the first time, or pardon me, a quarter of the people who tested positive the first time would end up positive on all three tests. Conversely, would that not mean that if you were in a situation where you were only doing one test instead of two or three or four, that you would naturally have many more people being reported positive just because you're doing fewer tests?
Oh, well, you know, your math is good. But there's actually other reasons for this idea that you presented, that if the accuracy appears to get better and better each time you run the ELISA, therefore there's more and more false positives the first time you ran it, it is not quite accurate. One of the reasons for what we call a false positive result in antibody testing is a bad test kit. In other words, that, say, 1 in 100 test kits might have had a little fleck of dust or something that got into the manufacturing process. And that test will light up positive no matter what you put in there, like distilled water even, and it'll come up positive at the end. So that's why it's recommended to repeat testing, because the chances that you're going to get a bad test kit twice in a row is very, very slim. So when you retest, that sample is going to probably, there's a 99% chance in this example I'm giving you, that it's going to land in a good test kit. And again, I can't tell you how accurate these tests are because there is no gold standard. So that makes it very difficult to talk about, because if you have an arbitrary standard in a given country, if that arbitrary standard or combination of test results comes up positive, then you're declared infected, period. It doesn't matter why.
Now, with regard to reasons why people can come up positive, I think, at least in my opinion, I would say we know it's not saying that HIV is there. What are reasons why people might test positive on these so-called HIV tests?
Well, there's many reasons, and there's a plethora of reasons published in the literature that are called false positive or cross-reacting antibodies, that you can have antibodies to a variety of things, and they will cross-react, and it'll appear like it's an HIV antibody. And we will never know because there is no gold standard again. And this can include vaccinations, I think genital warts, a whole plethora of conditions can cause these false positive reactions on the ELISA test. And then that's why it's recommended that you do referred to as a confirmatory test to rule out the possibility that was a cross-reacting antibody. But the Western blot does not do that. It does not rule it out, because the best that the manufacturers can say about a positive Western blot is that if you come up positive, let me back up, if you're positive on ELISA and you're also positive on our Western blot, you may have antibodies to HIV.
And it's true that the Western blot is also an antibody test. So if somebody has a false antibody reaction, there's a very high likelihood that that will show up on different kinds of antibody tests.
Well, yes, you'd expect that. If antibodies cross-react to a protein on one configuration, it's going to cross-react in another configuration. The extra accuracy of Western blot is that all the proteins are separated on basis of their size. So you get a whole spectrum of proteins on the Western blot, and then based on various combinations, you can say, well, this person has antibodies to five of the HIV proteins, and therefore it can't be a false positive.
Whereas with the ELISA, it's just they're having a reaction to the proteins as a group.
Right, just one. Could be one of them, could be more.
So when it breaks down into the Western blot, that's where we get into this area of interpretation. And I remember from a lecture that you did for the organization that I run, Alive and Well, you showed us that there's different standards of interpretation as to what proteins constitute or make up a positive reaction depending on the agency reading or giving the test. And you gave an example, if I recall correctly, that the blood banks have the lowest standard for testing positive. They have the fewest number of proteins needed to be considered HIV positive. But at the other end of the spectrum is the U.S. military, who requires reaction to the most proteins. And in each case, there's an agenda. The blood banks want to make sure that nothing dangerous or thought to be dangerous is getting in the blood supply, whereas the U.S. military does not want to turn away new recruits. Is that more or less correct to what you explained to us?
Well, yes, it is. The blood banks, the definition has changed over time, too, because blood banks are required, of course, to use FDA-approved products. Some labs use homemade products. The number of bands is what we refer to as stringent. How stringent do you want to be before you tell this person that they're positive for antibodies to HIV and therefore presumed to be infected with HIV? And clearly, the more bands that you require, the fewer people are going to turn up positive. So depending on your needs, you can tailor your test to your population to get the result you want. In particular, in Africa, where only a single antibody screening test, such as an ELISA or a rapid test, is used, you see very high prevalence of HIV. In my opinion, most likely, the majority of those are false positives.
When you say stringency, too, that brings up another question with regard to interpretation. I seem to recall you mentioning that when these tests were being developed, that in the beginning there were too many positives found among healthy blood donors, and there was great concern about the implications for that, and it was almost, I guess, decided that the stringency level had to be brought down if this test were going to have a practical application in the general population, because you couldn't have a bunch of healthy people testing positive.
That's right.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, it's sort of a strange story. When Abbott Laboratories released their test and after approval by the FDA, there was before that happened, actually, there was a dialogue amongst people in the blood banks, those in charge of public health, such as the CDC, researchers, etc. And it's like, what do we do, if a healthy blood donor tests positive? Can't we just, the blood banks said, well, we'll just throw that unit of blood away and call it a loss. But the Centers for Disease Control said, no, anybody that donates blood after the release of this test, I think it was March or April 1985, that they would have to be told about their positive result, and that they should go work it out with their doctor. And the reason, of course, that the CDC wanted to tell everybody that had a positive test result was to prevent further spread of infection. In other words, even if there's a chance that these people are infected, we have to let them know so that they can go to their doctor and they can stop spreading the virus in the public. Unfortunately, doctors had no tools at that time, nor do they today, to confirm an infection with HIV, so these people were left in a state of constant anxiety. I think the literature would suggest that there are about 50,000 blood donors within the first 2 years of the release of this test were told that they might be infected with HIV. It was a disaster. I mean, and many of those people would go home and probably tell their sexual contacts that I might be infected with HIV. Those persons would go on and tell their own sexual contacts the same. So this was a disaster at the social level of people being told that they might die and that they're healthy blood donors. So that's why the Western blot was the true motivation for why the Western blot was developed. It was in order to tell those blood donors you're not infected, because you, if you're holding out HIV to be deadly, first of all, you can't have 50,000 healthy blood donors out there. They should be sickly. So that's when the FDA put a very stringent criteria on calling the Western blot positive. A total of, you know, I think four bands or different combinations of bands. And finally, those people that were living a life of anxiety and terror could be told that they're not infected.
Or that they were.
Or that they were in very rare cases, yes.
Mm-hmm. But even then, it wouldn't necessarily be correct because we still don't have anything available to this day to confirm that idea.
Yeah, and based on the stringent definition of Western blot that was approved in 1987, probably 99% of those blood donors or even more could finally be told that they were not infected.
And does this not also mean that in a place like Africa where the Western blot is not used, that even if there were some true positives, that the majority of Africans are probably false positives because they're not getting the same amount, the same stringency of testing?
Well, yes. There's a direct correlation between the stringency and the number of false positives that are going to come up. And, of course, in Africa, most people don't even know whether they're antibody positive for HIV or not. These are surveys that are conducted on pregnant women that come to public pregnancy clinics, and their blood is drawn for syphilis testing, and the leftover blood is used for HIV diagnostic testing, and it's all anonymous. So it's very profitable business, and you know, the more people you can perceive to be infected, the more money's going to come in from donor organizations. So in a business sense, you don't want to be very stringent.
Right. Going on to the viral load test, there's since the, I guess, the mid-1990s even, the viral load test has risen to prominence. This is a genetic test and sort of has the feeling that it's much more accurate, because it's called viral load. Can you describe what the viral load test is? Specifically, does it measure the number of virus particles? And you had some experience developing such a test, so maybe you could talk about that as well.
Yeah, in fact, that was my field of expertise, was using genetic information to search for genetic information at the molecular level. A viral load test, like an antigen test, looks for a fragment of the germ. In this case, that fragment is the genetic material that's carried with the germ. And the idea is, if you see that genetic information or if you see that antigen, there's a higher probability that the entire germ is still there. But if you read the manufacturer's package insert for the HIV viral load test that's on the market, or tests, plural, that are on the market, all of them say, do not use this test for diagnosing infection with HIV. I mean, it's right up front. And the reason for that is there are false positives at that level as well. And apparently they're so prevalent, but depending on the study, the false positives that come out of HIV viral load testing are anywhere from 1 to 10%. So all of these tests say do not use this for diagnosing infection. The reason they were approved was for managing patients that are being treated. In other words, you want to observe the viral load, and if it goes up, you presume the virus has mutated, and you change medications. It's really been abused, and even mainstream researchers have emphasized in the literature that the HIV viral load test was never validated nor intended for use in diagnosing infection with HIV.
So in other words, there's never been a widespread survey of the healthy population to see how many of them would be positive on a viral load test when quite clearly they don't have the virus in their body.
Right. In at best, as I said, at least 1% of the population that is not infected would come up positive. And since we have about 300 million people in this country now, that would be about 3 million people would be told they're infected when indeed they're not, as compared to an estimated 1 million persons that are infected.
And if you're developing a genetic test for an RNA virus, would you not want to purify the virus to make sure that the RNA is really coming from the virus? And was that done when they developed viral load tests?
I would insist on it, of course, because I'm a chemist and that's the rules we play by. And that has never been done. The genetic information, like the reverse transcriptase activity, et cetera, is found in what's called HIV cultures, but we do not know where it came from. I mean, we don't know if it's from the virus. The human genome, these cultures are in human cells, and the human genome contains 1 to 2% retroviral sequences in what's called the nonsense regions of our chromosomes. Excuse me again. So this could have well come from the human cells in the culture as opposed to a virus.
With all of this discussion, as somebody who's been labeled HIV positive, I can't help but to wonder about the terminology around all of this, HIV test, HIV positive, HIV viral load. There's just a gap in the logic and the science and even in the ethics of this. If there is no HIV isolate, if there is no test that finds HIV, if there is no validation of tests not looking for HIV that finds someone something else by the finding of HIV, how can we even use these terms to describe anything? What is a false positive? What is a true positive when we aren't testing for the virus itself? We're testing for things associated with the virus, but none of the tests for the things have been validated by the ability to find the virus in people who test positive for the things. You know what I mean? It seems like a cruel and bizarre system that at some point prior to this moment would have become obvious to somebody somewhere along the line, and they'd say, well, hey, we need to resolve this matter. We're telling people all over the world in all kinds of circumstances that they're carrying, that they're infected with a deadly virus, yet we haven't found this virus in anybody. We haven't isolated this virus from cell culture. What are we doing? Why don't we go back and create the original experiments necessary to be able to tell people this with scientific accuracy and with, you know, the humanity in mind, the humanity of this situation?
Well, Christine, these issues get outside of my area of expertise a little bit. You're talking more about social political issues, and as well as you know, the political economy of this germ. But I really think that the first step is just start telling patients the truth. In other words, informed consent. I'm not anti-pharmaceutical. I'm pro-informed consent. And the truth is that the manufacturers of these tests make no such claim that they can be used to diagnose infection with HIV. And the new term really has become AID, A-I-D. And all the manufacturers say that my test kit is intended to aid in the diagnosis of HIV antibodies, for example. A thermometer is an aid to be used in the diagnosis of HIV/AIDS. And the package inserts also clearly state that the significance of a positive result in a healthy person is not known. The FDA had that same announcement in their news release in 1987 when the first Western blot was approved. And nobody pays attention to that. They have nobody knows what the meaning of these tests are in healthy persons. And the vast majority of people that are told that they're infected with HIV are healthy. In other words, they may have depressed by the new CDC definition of what AIDS is using the low T cell count. Those persons are still healthy. So it's baffling. And all these things that we hear, like HIV tests, HIV positive, viral load, that you mentioned, Christine, that jargon comes from recommendations from our public health institutions. these recommendations are not necessarily based on scientific evidence. And that's why you'll see a little footnote on the front of all of them, is that the recommendations contained in here may not fit the legal definition that the FDA has to abide by. So that's where you get these terminologies. And why does that happen? It's because everybody is conflicted. You know, everybody now that sits on panels to approve drugs, to approve diagnostic products, in one way or another is getting pharmaceutical money. Not everyone. I shouldn't generalize that to that broadly. And if, as a group, if you see antibodies equaling infection, and that means billions of dollars flowing into the HIV AIDS incorporated pipeline, it's easy to see it that way.
I wrote an article once called Manufacturing Certainty, which was an obvious reference to Noam Chomsky's book, Manufacturing Consent. But the observation I made was that modern medicine loves things that are certain. You know, this test is 99.999% accurate. You can believe this. This drug will work. It would be very much more difficult to do medicine if it was things like, well, there's a 75% chance you're infected with a deadly virus and a 25% chance there's absolutely nothing wrong with you at all. I don't think you'd get so many people taking drugs if they admitted there was some uncertainty, and if they admitted that there were fundamental unknowns, such as, you know, whether HIV has ever been purified and whether the viral load is really looking for HIV or something else, I don't think you'd get anybody to take drugs or assume that their life was over.
For a field and an endeavor that loves certainty, it seems to me there's a lot of uncertainty around what everybody's decided to agree that there's certainty about.
Yeah, and I hope that having Rodney on this show will get our listeners to understand some of those uncertainties a little bit better, because the impact of these tests psychologically, when somebody says with certainty you're HIV positive, is very powerful. And I think when they're kind of deconstructed, like you've helped us do, Rodney, I think that helps people understand that they may want to look at that result with a great deal more skepticism.
Yeah, I agree. And as I said, if people were just told the truth about the limitations of these tests, I think perhaps these tests might even be of some value. In other words, if you get a positive ELISA and a positive Western blot, and your physician came to you and said, well, you know what, according to the manufacturer, this says that you may have antibodies to HIV. And according to the CDC, persons with antibodies are presumed to be infected with the virus. At least, you know, you wouldn't terrify the person to death. And maybe the doctor could say, perhaps you should come back in 6 months if you have any symptoms, and we'll address this issue at a later time. But that's not clearly what happens.
You know, as somebody, again, who's had that conversation with the doctor that involved much more certainty, I still don't think that gets to the point of this. Because if you're giving people a test that can't tell if they have what you're suggesting they may have, all you're doing is creating that anxiety that you spoke about in the early days, Rodney, where blood donors were almost cruelly told you may have something that could possibly kill you, that you could possibly pass on to someone else and kill them, and we're not sure. It's not like that's really helpful.
Well, I agree. And in my opinion, these tests should be thrown in the trash. I mean, there's absolutely no reason for them at the individual level. And the reason that these tests are not going to go away, Christine, is because the battle between individual health and public health. And as long as it's perceived that there's an infectious agent that can spread into the general public, our public health officials need to have that that antibody test. And in other words, if you told an individual the things I mentioned earlier right up front, is that I can do this test, and if you come up positive, you may or may not have antibodies to HIV. You would be presumed to be infected, according to the CDC. They wouldn't take it. I mean, I wouldn't take it. I wanted to say, if you don't have a test that can tell me with any degree of certainty whether I'm infected or not, why would I take it?
And yeah. I think also if you tell people the social consequences, you know, if you take this test and test positive and have unprotected sex with somebody without telling them you're HIV positive, you could go to jail. And if you're a woman and you have a baby, we may take your baby away. I think that would give a lot of people second thoughts as well.
Well, those are very serious side consequences, yeah. As a sort of a corollary to this whole practice.
Right.
And yeah, and if there was a test on the market that said that this test can detect HIV, FDA approved, with even 80% certainty, I'd say use it. But you're right, the criminalization of HIV/AIDS is becoming a serious problem. On the other hand, in Africa, where governments are trying to employ this same strategy of criminalization, they see a drop in people coming forward to be tested. And in many countries, there's no treatment available yet anyway, so why would they go get tested and later put themselves at risk to go to prison for passing on or appearing to pass on a positive antibody result?
Yeah, that's good questions. I can't thank you enough for being on our show today, Rodney. It's been great to talk to a true expert on this issue.
Well, I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you very much, Rodney. Certainly what you've brought up will lead to many questions on the part of our listeners. And I think that in a situation like the one we have, the best we can do is ask these questions and demand answers, because the answers, it seems, aren't there in the scientific literature.
You're right. And I actually did publish a article in the electronic version of the British Medical Journal demanding that the research community develop an HIV test. And I really think that all these people that have been living a life of fear and terror deserve such a test. But until such time that we actually have an HIV test, we'll have to employ other methods to try to get information to people.
Thank you.
Well, that was great, listening to such a world expert on HIV testing, and somebody who's obviously come a long way from his initial beliefs in the HIV/AIDS paradigm.
I'm still struck with the whole surreal nature of this thing called an HIV test that isn't an HIV test. I remember in our art history classes, we looked at those paintings by Magritte, the French surrealist, including the one where it's a painting of a pipe, and underneath it, it says, "This is not a pipe." And here you have an antibody test that underneath that title says, "There is no standard for diagnosing the presence or absence of HIV antibody in human blood." It's so surreal.
I remember listening to a book tape of Death on the Nile, a famous Agatha Christie book, and there's a scene in there where this young heiress is just about to sign her fortune away to the scam artist, and somebody comes up and interrupts this thing that's going on and tells her, "Always read what you're about to sign." But how many people read the HIV testing literature, which is essentially their death warrant if they believe it? How many people are even given those labels? I don't even think most doctors have those labels.
Yeah, it's quite a situation. Well, David, in our next show, which will be podcast number 7, we have a very interesting guest, a gentleman from out here in California, West Hollywood, California, who came down with symptoms that would very readily be called AIDS, especially because he's a gay man. Sudden precipitous weight loss, then neurological disorders, numbness, and eventually paralysis, and just general immune breakdown. But he was not inclined to take an HIV test and not inclined to accept an easy label. He found his own solution working with alternative health practitioners and went from someone who was so bad off he could barely speak or move, and he's fine. And he has a very interesting story to tell, and he'll be with us in the next podcast, number 7.
I can't wait to talk to him. That sounds extremely interesting and hopefully we'll get other people who've experienced some of the same things thinking about that.
Yes.
I'd just like to say thanks to all of our listeners. I hope you've enjoyed this show, and more than that, I hope you found it useful, thought-provoking, and challenging. If you have, tell your friends about it, and let's see if we can get to 5,000 downloads by our next podcast.
That would be wonderful. Well, thank you, David, and goodbye, everyone. Until the next time.
Goodbye.